Sushriye, Namo Uttamashriye Soha. O Namo Manjushriye, Namo Sushriye, Namo Uttamashriye Soha. O Namo Manjushriye, Namo Sushriye, Namo Uttamashriye Soha. Thank you. Okay. So we begin by letting go of everything that we've done so far, all the activities of lunch and karma yoga. Just letting it go on the out breath. Being grounded here and now. Bringing the mind inward. Releasing any tension on a natural out breath. Giving yourself a quick body check, making sure your forehead is smooth, round in between the eyes is spacious, the face is relaxed, the shoulders are dropped, the tummy is not clenched, all of this. At this stage, being still is quite important. And changing your focus to the in-breath. So each natural in-breath, allow your mind to brighten, become clear, become sharp. Setting a strong positive motivation for this afternoon, Mahayana motivation. And just focus on that for a bit. And the topic for this afternoon is impermanence. Impermanence, the bedrock of Buddha Dharma, bedrock. Within Tibetan Buddhism, they say there are four seals, four stamps of necessity, four seals of Tibetan Buddhism. The first one, all conditioned phenomena are impermanent. All conditioned phenomena are impermanent. The second seal, all contaminated phenomena are the nature of suffering. All phenomena, number three, all phenomena are selfless and empty. And the fourth seal, Nirvana alone is peace. Thank you. So I'm hoping you had a nice lunch. The karma yoga wasn't too extensive and you were able to get some sunshine. That would be nice. So of course, with Buddhism, really important that we understand the context and the definition of such an important word as impermanence. We talked before about the fact that when we look at permanence and impermanence in our world, impermanence has a connotation of something negative, something not really worthy, whereas permanence has this connotation of being quite worthy. And if you had a choice, of course, you would choose permanence. Within the Buddha Dharma, though, impermanence is a condition. It's a condition. It is a produced condition. Produced by causes and conditions. Phenomena are impermanent because they arise in dependence upon their causes and conditions. They're impermanent because the phenomena arise independent upon their parts. And because they arise in dependence upon the mind that labels them. And so we think, well, what is conditioned phenomena? Every aspect of our reality. Every aspect of our reality is impermanent in one or all of these three ways. Because they're produced, arise dependently on causes and conditions, or their parts, or the mind that labels. So we have to consider permanence now in relation to this. How does Buddha Dharma talk about permanence? Well, if something were permanent, it would donate an unchanging state of affairs. Something that was unchanging would be labeled permanent. So if someone wanted a definition of permanence from a Buddha Dharma point of view, you would say the word permanence donates an unchanging state. A permanent thing, if we label it permanent, would be something that does not change from a cause to a result. A permanent thing cannot change from a cause to a result. It's permanent. A permanent thing can't be part of a dynamic process. Because the act of creation really changes the creator. And so, from a Buddha Dharma point of view, when they're considering permanence and impermanence, you could say that if someone says a permanent cause, it's self-contradictory. Now, we'll go into that in more detail, we'll have to, when we look at emptiness. But for this moment, when we're talking about permanence, we are talking about something that is a dependent arising. It arises in dependence upon. Anything that arises in dependence upon causes and conditions. Rises in dependence on its parts. Arises in dependence of the mind that labels it so. All of that donates an impermanent phenomenon. And everything in our existence comes into being in these ways. There is a time when you can talk about a permanent phenomena, but it's nothing in this life and in this existence. Everything you see, everything you interact with, you yourself, the cup you're holding, the pen you're using, your family, your friends, this country, all of it is impermanent. We'll look into permanence a bit later in relation to emptiness. But at the moment, everything we interact with is an impermanent phenomenon. So if you can just hold on to that for a moment, let's examine some of this phenomena and see if it's true. Let's examine some of this phenomenon. So once more, please get yourself into a meditative state, a good position. Let go on the out-breath, brighten on the in-breath. Remaining still if you can. Begin to internally examine all parts of your body. Don't skip anything. Start at the crown, work your way to the feet. Begin to examine it, everything. Probe any texture, probe shape, temperature, density, fluidity, the body at work, all movement. Begin to examine that. Make your mind travel and identify all these different parts. Down to your muscles, your tendons, the different systems in the body, the different organs, the different fluids, the heat, the cold, all of it. As you're examining these, can you feel the movement, the change? Is there anything you're examining that seems static? Even your bones that feel so dense are shedding cells and building up other cells. What is there that you're examining that is not changing? go to a subtler level, cellular, molecular levels. Anything there static and unchanging. Or is there constant movement, reproduction, dying off, disintegrating? And with the rest of your body, always in motion, always changing. Try to immerse your mind in this constant fluctuation. Perhaps outside of yourself, you'll find something permanent. So expand your awareness now to this room that you're in. I mean, at first, all seems kind of solid, kind of static. Yet you know that everything in this room is a mass of tiny particles whizzing around, gathering, dispersing, expanding, contracting, always in motion, always fluctuating. Try to tap into that and stay with that fluctuations. if everything external cannot be the source of genuine, lasting happiness, and we don't grasp at it because it makes no sense. But it also makes no sense to get frustrated or dwell in prolonged grief. Consider if that's reasonable. Perhaps if we look at our consciousness, we'll find something permanent there. So becoming aware of your mind, just becoming aware of what's presented to your mind right now. It becomes clear that our consciousness has the same fluctuation, the same change, up and down. Experiences of sadness and happiness, love and anger, memories, ideas, thoughts, concepts. All of this can crowd the mind. It's permanently in flux, permanently changing. And because this condition is impermanent, all these phenomena, external and internal in our mind, are impermanent, we have the power to change. If things were permanent, you couldn't change it. But it's impermanent, not intrinsic to who you really are. And so, the very problem of impermanence becomes the way out. Because it's impermanent, we have the power to change, develop, and transform mind and lives. As we come to the end of this particular short meditation, try to generate a strong determination in your mind to become even more familiar with the transient nature of all things. Not just to accept the constant flux as a reality, but to expect it. Try to generate that in your mind. When it's as strong as you could make it, let go of any mental chatter and focus on your conclusion or positive thought. Just focus. Thank you. Now, I am sure that's not a new idea to anybody. Is that true? You actually know this for for reality, don't you? This constant flux. Hello. Thank you. Oh, I wish I was in the room. I can't hear. It's very difficult. So we're not trying to teach anybody to suck eggs here. You know this is true, don't you? You know this is the way life is. It's just we don't think about it this way. But we know it's true. So where does our problem come in? Our problem comes in because the intelligent and intellectual understanding of this is at odds with how we behave. That's the problem. If we behaved in our life in relation to the reality of impermanence, our life would be a lot happier, but we do not. We teach this and people go, I knew that. In fact, the only people I ever came across that didn't know this were some people I taught in prison. They were very surprised. I remember one prisoner saying, are you telling me that this chair is whizzing about? I'm saying, yes. And they said, the floor. I said, the floor. I mean, they were really shocked. But generally speaking, people are not shocked. This is in line with their intellectual understanding. The dichotomy comes in our behavior. We do not apply that to our behavior. Why do you think there is such a disconnect? Just 5 minutes in pairs. Just 5 minutes in pairs. See if you can give me an answer to that. Why is there a disconnect between our intellectual understanding and how we behave? Just 5 minutes. So what did you come up with? Why is there a disconnect? Well, maybe you don't think there's a disconnect. I don't know if anyone's speaking. I can't hear.
Can you hear me then, Mary?
I can hear you. Sorry, I just thought I could see Anna speaking, but I couldn't hear anything. Nope, still can't hear anything. Could someone say something, see if I can hear it? No. Yes, Anna.
Well, I guess we all wish you'd be here in person. Be a lot easier. I just thought for conventional purposes in everyday life, it's a lot, you know, it's practical in some instances to just not always think of things in flux, but just, you know, to use the conventional sort of permanence, so to speak, of this table, because it's kind of solid and permanent enough for me to put my stuff on. So I think in sort of everyday conventional life, there is a certain practicality in assuming things are static, solid and permanent.
If that were a choice,
I think there's also, and I mean that was the other thing that we were sort of saying, I think there is also, you know, basic sort of level of understanding and education, maybe, that, like you said, about the intellectual curiosity. And I mean, from my experience of prison, I mean, I think the literacy rate is sometimes not way above 50%. You know, what are those people, you know, background do they
have? I understand, but let's leave them out of it just now. In this room here and now, is there a dichotomy between intellectual understanding of impermanence? Is there?
Yes.
And the reality. Okay, so sticking with us, it's not a choice. This dichotomy is not a choice. We don't think to ourselves, okay, I'm going to see things as permanent so I can put things down. What it is, it's habit. It's habit over many, many lifetimes. And when you have a strong habit over many, many lifetimes, you start to act and have a habit of overriding your intellectual understanding and behaving as if the opposite were true. And what the Dharma is saying is if you behave as if the opposite is true, you will grasp onto something as permanent. And I want it. It's permanent. This will be a source of happiness. It will never change. Even though we know it will never change, intellectually we know that, but still, we run after the same things that give us pain and suffering time after time after time because it changes. There is very little choice here unless you make the choice to see things as they are. The choice is not to see things as permanent because it's useful. We already see them as permanent. And the Dharma says, really, it's not as if you're making any choice. We're almost born with this innate ignorance to see things as solid, permanent, inherently existing. Our intellectual understanding undermines that, but not to any great degree. Not to any great degree. And so we interact with each other. My lover will always love me. My child will always obey me. This cake will always be delicious. This work will always provide me with an income. Everything. This house will always be mine. This country will always be safe. Holidays will always bring me pleasure. Do you see? You interact this way. Because we haven't let intellectual understanding that all of this is unchanged. All of this is changing. If we were acting as if we to that reality, you wouldn't grasp. You'd enjoy things on a pleasant, and you might even avoid something that's causing you a bit of unpleasant, but you wouldn't have a grasping and you wouldn't have strong aversion. Because what? It would like be sticking your hand in a bowl of water and grasping water. There is nothing there to grasp. This is the crux of all our problems. When Buddhism says impermanence is the first and major seal of Tibetan Buddhism, this is what they're talking about. This is what we're talking about. It's huge. We do not behave in sync with reality. Is it useful to see things as permanent? From our habit way of thinking as a human being stuck in samsara, sure. As a human being with a precious human rebirth, perfect human rebirth, who's trying to see things as they are and escape the cycle of existence, then it's poison. It's poison. And it's really asking us, it's saying to us, intellectually, you know this is true. You must make effort to make your behavior in sync with reality. Because as long as it's out of sync with reality, suffering will ensue. And intellectual will become just intellectual. Intellectual understanding of stuff is so important, but not as important as experiencing it directly. Because it's with experiencing directly that it changes. So we've got lifetime after lifetime of habits of clinging, desire, aversion to people and objects because we keep thinking that our happiness is out there and that's permanent. Even though up here you know it is, you don't behave as if it is. This person will always bring me happiness and joy. And even if you say to yourself, well, it could change, you don't really believe it. At that moment when you observe that particular phenomenon, no. You see it as kind of permanent. You may agree that you see impermanence because of some sort of outside condition. For instance, you can remember the Twin Towers and the planes coming into the Twin Towers. I don't think anybody will forget that. So some we see impermanence like that because we're not stupid. We know what impermanence is. We see impermanence as something that's happening outside, lands on a permanent object and makes it impermanent due to external conditions. It's how we see life. We know we grow old, but it's very hard to notice when it's happening. What we don't come to grasp with and what we have to come to grasp with is impermanence is happening as part of the nature of phenomena. It is the nature of phenomena to be impermanent. It is the nature of phenomena to change. Not just due to external conditions, but due to the very nature of all phenomena. We all know people who will do so much to prevent change, don't we? I mean, to keep everything you've got, you'll ensure it. You'll put locks on your door. You'll behave in a certain way to keep things kind of permanent. How you think of yourself. That's the most permanent thing of all. You can say, of course I change. Look, I've got more gray hair. You know, I've got more wrinkles. But you still think there's something within you. I'm saying not you, all sentient beings, as if there's something permanent. I'm going to say a few words. I want you to fill in the gaps. Let's say you say to someone, I am. What response do you make? I am, if you were to fill in that gap, what would you, don't tell me, just mentally fill in that gap. You're having a conversation with someone, you say, I am, what would you say? Whatever you say, I bet there's a solidity about it, because that's I am. What about saying to someone, I always, well, how would you fill that gap in? I always. Whatever your response is, there's a taste of permanence about it, if not solid. If you say to someone, well, you know, you're having a conversation, you'll say, I never. What would you say then? I never what? You'll see it as real. You'll see it as permanent. Or it'll have a strong taste of permanence about it. If you say, I like this, what is it? I dislike that. Right? Whatever answer you give, that hallucination of permanence is surrounding it. Most of all, you're having a conversation over a nice coffee and someone says to you, what do you believe? And you say, well, it's tricky, but generally speaking, I believe. And then something comes out of your mouth. I'm not saying any of this is wrong. I'm saying this idea of permanence is an innate ignorance that comes from life to life. Unless we shine a light on exactly what it is, exactly where it is, and exactly how it affects how we behave within society, to each other and to ourselves, then the sink between reality and how we behave will always be discordant, always. And the Dharma is asking us to behave in sync with reality. If you're not in sync with reality, then this self-existing I is so solid. It'll take a bulldozer to get through it. They say one of the differences between a Buddha and a sentient being is a Buddha doesn't have a self-cherishing I. The solid I. If we learn and if we work with the reality of impermanence, it will loosen the grip on the self-existing I. It's one of the major ways of loosening that grip on a self-existing I. You can't leave it by saying, well, I know everything is impermanent. I know it. There's a lot of things we know. But when it comes to reality, we need to put that knowledge into practice. All of this is internal, of course. This is most of Buddha Dharma is an internal change. It's not as if you're going around going, this is impermanent. Why should you be doing nothing like that? Just when you're in situations and things occur, remembering the impermanent nature, very useful. One of the most useful ways to loosen the grip of self-cherishing I is impermanence. Nothing works, seems to work as well. You're all quiet this afternoon. Okay, am I getting too heavy maybe? Any comments on that? When the second seal says, the first seal is all conditioned phenomena are impermanent. The second seal is all contaminated phenomena are the nature of suffering. What do you think they're contaminated with? It's not the coronavirus. What is it contaminated with? Yes, Gabriel.
Ignorance?
Yes. Especially? Permanence. Seeing permanence. Yes, yeah, exactly. That's why it's contaminated. And then the third seal gives you the truth of it. All phenomena are selfless and empty. What that's saying is, it's selfless in that there is nothing within that phenomena that is permanent. There is nothing within that phenomena that's self-existent. There is nothing within that phenomena that is inherently existent. That phenomena came about by causes and conditions, and you can't tell me any different. And then it says, empty. What it means is, certainly in this retreat, start to think not empty. When you think of emptiness, think empty of, right? The translation was a bit odd, emptiness. It seems so negative. So it's best to think empty of. What are phenomena empty of? The clue is in what the meditation is about. It is empty of permanence. It's empty of anything self-existing. All phenomena. Any comments? What do you think? Yes.
I think the problem is not the intellectual knowledge, but the overcoming the intuitive experience.
For some people, it is the intellectual understanding. I mean, for some, but not these days, not many. Most people have got, I find most people very, very bright. They know all this. And it becomes a piece of knowledge that they know, alongside other pieces of knowledge that they know, that they very rarely put into practice. But still, it's knowledge. It's intellectual understanding. But this is about everyday life, from the moment we wake up to the moment we go to sleep. And if you can do it when you're awake, see things for what they are, you'll be able to do it when you're asleep. You'll do it in your dreams. And if you can see reality as it is in your dreams, you'll see reality in the bardo. You'll see reality there. No fear, no grasping, no aversion. You see? So please take a bit of a stretch, because we're going to do another meditation. Okay. So once more, as you settle, getting your body, your speech, your mind into the right state. Because our next topic is death, then consciousness is going to be important. So this meditation is about consciousness, your own consciousness, as you experience it. Settling the body, relaxing, sharpening the mind. Being here and now. Being still. Try to tap into your thoughts now. You're trying to say to yourself, what is my present state of mind? It could be irritability. It could be happy. It could be sleepy, whatever. Try to tap into your mind now and the state it's in. So although your mind might be a little bit blank, really what's happening is that thoughts, ideas, emotions are flashing by quickly. If they are, try to observe it with detachment. We're now going to skim back in timeline our consciousness to the moment we woke up this morning. So start remembering what the consciousness was like as you walked into the gompa. When you were doing karma yoga, what was going on in the mind then? Having lunch. Being outside, the teaching this morning, breakfast, and the moment you woke up. Do you think that was the same stream of consciousness when you woke up as you have now? Remember, I'm not talking about a moment of mind, I'm talking about a stream of consciousness. Is that your stream of consciousness now, traveling back all the way to the moment you woke up? Last night, when you were in bed sleeping, did you dream? If you did, was that dreaming mind part of this stream of consciousness that you have now? Now continue to trace back. It's easy to trace back if you can remember certain experiences of, let's say, yesterday. Can you get the feeling that it's the same stream of consciousness that you're experiencing now? What about a week ago? Same stream of consciousness? A month ago? You were alive, you had a stream of consciousness. Can you link it to this stream of consciousness? A year ago? Can you see that it's the same stream of consciousness? Continue to your timeline going back and back not getting caught up in any experience, simply just identifying moments that were your stream of consciousness and seeing how it links to this stream of consciousness. If you can, go back to childhood, asking yourself the same question. What about when you were an infant? Same stream? Some people can remember their moment of birth. At that moment you were born, you had a stream of consciousness. Can you see that link between that stream of consciousness and the stream of consciousness you have now? Just be relaxed, open your mind. Allow memories to arise. If it's difficult, not to worry, just experience any of the continuity that you can remember. When you were in your mother's womb, what about that stream of consciousness? That stream of consciousness that flows moment to moment, with one moment of mind giving rise to the next. Now you ask yourself a question. Is my mind stream of experience, did it begin at a certain point? What do you believe? This continuous flow, moment to moment of consciousness in the mother's womb, is that still your stream of consciousness? If so, did it begin at a certain point? Did it come from parents? If so, how and when? Perhaps you think it came from, well, nowhere. It's been said to me before. Did it come from nowhere without any causes and conditions? It just appeared. Is that even possible? Now gently become aware of the present moment again, your thoughts, sensations. Just let the experience of your mind flow. Try to project forward now. Perhaps when you're having your supper. Can you see how your flow of consciousness now will reach when you're having supper? Project the concept to the rest of the day. Can you see how it would be the same stream, ever changing but ever flowing? Into tomorrow, in the months and years ahead, this stream of consciousness? And now you're on your deathbed. You don't have long. What do you think happens next to this consciousness? Consider different possibilities. Do I cease to exist? Or do I transform and continue? Because one moment of mind gives rise to the next without any need of an object. And as I continue, will I encounter new experiences? Continue to explore, try to reason a little, open the mind. The possibility of this continuum going moment to moment and life to life. The Buddha Dharma says that the mind is a series of ever-changing moments, each the result of the previous moment. If that's true, how could it have a beginning in time? And how could it have an end in time? How valuable it would be on every level to become familiar with the transitory nature of all things, to see and behave, accept and expect constant flux as a reality. Thank you. That was just a bit of a cheery meditation. Get you ready for whatever. Okay. Any thoughts, comments about that particular meditation? Useful, not useful? The rationale for doing it, especially at this stage?
I'm interested in the rationale, but I've got a terrible memory, so I found it very, very difficult to remember. So I understood the point of it, but I found it. And also, I think when you've got difficult periods of your life, there were definite periods which I sort of like thought, right, okay, I'm hopping over that.
Can I ask, have you had a recent bereavement?
Yes, quite a few.
Okay. Yeah. I won't say anymore. I just.
No.
I understand. No.
Yeah. No, so I could physically, I'm not physically, I could feel myself like pulling away a bit. But yeah. I understood the rationale.
Sure. Death is the one thing that motivates so many people. It's the one thing that drives, I tend to look at a lot of not religious programs, but different religions. I'm very interested in that. I'm interested why people go into it. And I'm interested in why people move out. It's just something I'm always interested in. And really this fear of death and this kind of wish and hope for some sort of permanent solution, you know, is a real driver here. Yes. Thank you, Sarah. Anyone else? Yes, Tim.
Yeah, I find it very useful. And yes, so I can see that there's kind of two models. So I've got a scientific medical background. And so instinctively, I was brought up, I'm still find it difficult to see that the mind is different from the brain.
So, yes. So
when you see people dying, etc., then that's the end of all this experience, my kind of consciousness with me, etc. So, and a kind of strict scientific basis, when you look at atoms and molecules, etc., then it's not easy. But I think if you then step into the different model, which is also congruent within itself, as in mind, no end, perpetual, that also makes sense. And I'm in a position where I'd say, yes, I know teachers, I trust, so I can use the permanent mind stream as a working hypothesis, but it's not something I can say, yes, I can.
Yeah. That's more than understandable, because it's how we're brought up, you know. I mean, it's how we're brought up. And if you remember, I started this particular series of teachings talking about how many people think either the mind does not exist. I've had scientists say that the mind is that which is produced by the brain, right? And the outcome of that, of course, is that the mind is produced by the brain. When the brain dies, so does the mind. I mean, that's reasonable. And Stephen Hawking famously, the mind is that which is vomited up by the brain, for sure. And it's a materialistic view. You can understand why, because science has brought us so far. Without science, we'd be in caves, I'm sure of it. So it's not, the thing about His Holiness says, you never finish science, but the problem is they can't prove the mind doesn't exist. They've not proved so far that the mind is a product of the brain. What they have proved is strong correlation, of course. And I spent some time on that, if you remember, on the correlations. But certainly within Dharma, it really is almost a given, beginningless and endless mind. Remember I said, beginningless and endless mind is a given. But to us, we don't just accept it. We have to think about it. We have to meditate on it. We have to at least to see it's a possibility. If we don't, and if we say, and remember we did that meditation, can something physical, like the brain, produce something non-material, like the mind? Do you remember that meditation? I bet you don't. You do you? Really? And can something that's non-material produce something that is material? None of that is proved in science, none of it. There is strong correlation, but Buddhists nobody argues that. Someone, as you know, His Holiness the Dalai Lama does mind sciences, meetings every year with the top scientists. And I remember one book I have, someone said to His Holiness, yeah, but if science proves something, could prove something that went against what Buddhism said, what would you do? And he very clearly said, then we change that aspect of Buddhism. We would change it. Of course you would. Why wouldn't you? We're not stupid. We're not Neanderthals. But that really has not been proven. It is believed, and how it's portrayed certainly in the press as if it's the same. And in fact, mind and brain are often used interchangeably as if they were the same thing. But in Dharma, it is not. In Dharma, mind is non-material. It cannot be produced by something material. There's nothing that you can show that. Even in science, if science proved it, I think we'd have to change quite a bit. But it hasn't. And science, because it can't prove it, never goes internally. They stay external. There's nothing wrong with that. We benefited from that so much. But they have there is no value in most scientific circles going inward. None at all. They throw things at you like, well, that's just subjective. Well, yes, of course. But we value subjective stuff. We value science, but we also value inner experience. And if your inner experience, based on a valid mind, not just because you've decided to think it, but based on a valid mind, comes to the conclusion that mind is beginningless and endless, then you're saying something quite substantial. Because if mind is beginningless and endless, reincarnation happens. I say reincarnation, but the reality becomes that there's no such thing as birth, aging, sickness, and death. There's no real cutoff points between childhood, infancy, teenager, adult, old age, death. All those are concepts which allow you to use your conceptual idea of time, beginning and end, beginning of infancy, end of infancy. That's how we deal with life, and it's useful. We just don't believe it. But imagine if you did believe and you understood that mind was beginningless. Then even the word reincarnation would not be necessary. At the moment, we still hold on to that reincarnation, right? Because it happens. But imagine if you truly believed it. You wouldn't even need the word reincarnation. It would simply be one moment of mind giving rise to the next. It would be like a river running through many, many different countries. In this country, it's called, I don't know, the Volga. I'm no use at geography. It's called one name. The same river flows into another country. It's called something else. The river is the same. It's just moving. It goes into another country. It's called something else. It's the same river. But it's helpful for us to say, this is this river in my country, and these are the borders. And your next door neighbor country will say, yes, and this is our river. This part of it is ours. The fact that it's flowing all the time and there's not one molecule that was there 5 minutes ago that hasn't moved on, but still, this is ours. Because it's easy to deal with. And there's nothing, that's reasonable. You deal with it. The problem is we see that as true, real. Borders, of course. I mean, take a country, I don't know, Germany, for instance. We have an idea of all countries. I mean, take Scotland, but take any country. We're fixed idea where our country begins, where the middle of that country is, and where it ended. But 150 years ago, that wasn't the case. All borders change all the times. The name of the countries change. The people in the country change, but we still have this fixed idea. So it's like if you look at conception and perception, what it is, there's a generic image that we use. We all have our conceptual minds. And the thing about a conceptual mind is that it doesn't see the object directly. It sees it hazed by a kind of generic image. And we believe that generic image to be true. It really is worth thinking about, and it's worth coming to some form of conclusion. If beginningless mind is not the case, then you would say, well, no, we can prove that the mind and the brain is something that's vomited up by the brain. It's only an expression of the brain, nothing else. If you can prove that, we'd have to change our whole, in 2,500 years, change everything. This is what His Holiness said. He didn't say that particularly. What he said was, if science can prove something that is against what Buddhism says, Buddhism should change. I would love to hear a scientist say that. In fact, I thought that was an idea of science. It was always testing the water. always changing the boundaries, never being frightened of getting something wrong. It's just more information that goes in the pot. But how it's presented, particularly in the press, is if it's solid, real, unchanging. The mind is the brain. Of course it is. But that has ramifications. That means when you die, if that is true, when you die, your consciousness dies. And it doesn't take much research to find out this is not true. It doesn't really take much research to find out about reincarnation. It really doesn't. And even if you're only willing to speak to scientists and not just families that can prove this, then Ian Stevenson's work, which is still going on in the University of Virginia about reincarnation, still going on. And the only reason it's still going on is not because the university likes it, the university doesn't like it, but it's almost self-funding now. They produce paper after paper after paper. Are these scientists idiots? No, they're not. But what they decided to, and they're not Buddhist either. They're simply scientists, but they've decided to look into a topic which science tends to ignore because it is not measurable, observable, or repeatable. It's a thought, yes? I remember, when the Tibetans first settled in India and people started traveling, when they got back to the Tibetan community, what did the Tibetans ask them? They said, what's Mount Meru like? Right? Because they completely believed that at the center of the world, there was this big mountain called Mount Meru. And on top of this mountain lived various beings. And so when these people came back from traveling, they would say, what was Mount Meru like? Where was it? And they're saying, it doesn't exist. What do you mean it doesn't exist? It doesn't exist. And it took a while, but eventually enough people traveled and saw it didn't exist. So now when they talk about Mount Meru, it's allegorical. You won't find Tibetans now who believe Mount Meru exists. Why? Because people traveled, people saw, people changed their mind. But this went on for thousands of years. Anyway. I suppose what we could say is this, everything that we study and learn in the Dharma, everything, it has one real reason. It's to move us away from the fantasy of unreality. Is to move us away from misknowing how things actually are. Towards how things actually are. It really is about moving away from error, moving away from fantasy. I can't think of one aspect of Dharma that doesn't do that. And it moves it towards an understanding of reality. It all starts there, an understanding of reality, how we exist, why we exist, what experiences we have in life, all the dramas and the complex of life, giving explanations to that. At the heart of all this is impermanence, this nature and function of the mind. It's the foundation of all of it. And then you come to the most unmissable, changeable, impermanent thing that we have to look forward to, and that's death. And Dharma really is, it looks at this very, very, very closely and often. Kabji Lama Zopa Rinpoche said, a day thinking without death, without thinking of death, is a day wasted. So Buddhists tend to think about death not to get upset, but actually to give yourself energy. It really is about trying to give yourself, understand what death is, to give yourself energy. It's not about getting depressed. It really isn't. So in the Buddhist world, what you could say is this. We acknowledge, not just acknowledge death, but we acknowledge all the emotions that arise with the death process, all of it. Everything that arises in the face of death. But Buddhism is asking you to face the nature of these emotions and these things that arise. Face their nature, not to get caught up in the tyranny of the expression of death. So all of it's acknowledging. Buddhism does not say it doesn't mean, no. Death is a big thing in Dharma. Big. And all the emotions, everything that comes up, of course, everybody needs help with that. We all do. But Tindharma is asking you to look at everything that comes up, face, really look at it, look at its nature, look at its nature, and don't get caught up what they call the tyranny of the expression of it. So that I would say that would be the heart of looking at death carefully. Now, of course, there's many vast ways of studying death, yes. There are loads in all the different things. Not only is there different approaches, but each, if you're approaching teaching about death, there's many ways you can go at it. You can start to look at something like owning your own death, right? How do I own my own death? How can I take charge of this? I'm actually teaching this in Liverpool next month over a series of weeks. And that would be a particular set of teachings. You could look at it, you could have a whole set of teachings on how to help other people at the time of death. That's a whole set of teachings, how to help others. But I will say, everybody wants to know how to help other people at the time of death, not terribly keen at looking at their own death. And so if you really want to help others at the time of death, you really have to look closely at your own death, owning your own death. Then you can take what you learn into helping others. I think we're getting better at this as a society. We seem to be getting better in dealing with death. Certainly more people are talking about it. I've been around Europe, I've been to a few death cafes. Has anybody here been to a death cafe? No, very interesting. In the morning, I went to a cat cafe, full of cats. And the next day, I went to a death cafe. So there's more programs on death. People seem to be talking about it more. So we're looking at really our oldest illusion, really, is this mortality. And so when people, normal people, when they start thinking about their own death, of course, fear can come. And what happens when we think of our own death with fear? People try to ignore it. They try to suppress it. They try to push death far in the future. I did my master's degree in aging, the science of aging. And one of the little bits of research we did was to see what people think old age was. See if they could put a label on it, a number. And it was quite consistent. People seemed to say consistently that the date of old age seemed to be 10 years older than what they were. It's quite consistent. If we have difficulty thinking of old age, thinking about death is even more so. We push the idea of old age, we push the idea of death just far enough in the distance that it's not so much of a threat. Now, what's the Dharma asking us to do? Never forget it. Think about it often. If you think about it in the morning, the Dharma says, in the right way, not with grief, not with anger, not with fear, but think about it in the right way. It is the best motivating factor for the rest of the day. So that's how Buddhists look at death. Now, does that mean we all behave like that? No, not at all. When my mother died, I was absolutely devastated. I'd been a nun for years. I was devastated. However, the teachings helped me that it wasn't as deep as it could have been, and it didn't last as long because reality started kicking into me. So we're not trying to suppress anything. We're human. We're human. We will grieve. But you could grieve within reality as opposed to grieving within a fantasy. Dharma's very clear. We must step out of the illusion of permanence in all its forms, and we need to step into the reality of impermanence and all its forms. If you ever watch great teachers, thinking of His Holiness and Lama Zopa, Lama Yeshe, when they ascended the throne, before they sit down, you'll see them gathering their robes. Then you'll see them do this. Snap their fingers. All of them do that. That snapping of the fingers is to remind themselves of emptiness. The impermanent nature of all reality. Impermanence. Emptiness. That's why they snap their finger. You'll see, if you ever watch a teaching, watch before they sit down. Snap the fingers. It's that important. They never forget it. I'd like you to, Mary, could you hand out those sheets? What you're being handed now is one of the most important death meditations within the Tibetan Buddhism. It's the most popular, and it's said to be the most useful way to meditate on death. If you look at it, it says how to cultivate mindfulness of death by way of the 9-point meditation. So there's three routes. With each route, there's 3 points. At the end of the 3 points, there is a conclusion or a resolution. And so how you meditate on that, you meditate on each point like a glance meditation, and you come to some form of conclusion like, knowing I have to die, I must resolve to practice Dharma. And at that point, you stop all mental talk and just hold that resolution in your mind for as long as you can. And then you go on to route 2 and route 3. So if you're willing to do that in group study, my suggestion would be that you have 3 groups this evening. Each one of you take one of the routes, discuss the 3 points, then see if you can come to a personal conclusion, a personal resolution. See if you can rewrite the conclusion that's put there. That's something that's more meaningful to you, maybe something more immediate to you. I wouldn't take more than about 15, 20 minutes for that. Wouldn't take more than that. And then if you come together, maybe share. So group 1 would do route 1, group 2, route 2. So you don't have to do all of it. You do 1 and the other groups will do the other 2. Then come together and share what you've got. So that's my suggestion, simply because I know this really is one of the most important, could be life-changing meditations, coming to grips with that. Would you be willing to do that? Is that reasonable? Okay, I hope so. But again, if it's not your bag of tricks, if you really think, I'm sorry, but today I cannot do this, then you do something else, of course. I used to, when we did things like this, if I wasn't there, I would do very set things to do, but everybody's in a different state. So I put it forward only as a suggestion. Now, this can be quite a particular long meditation if you're doing all 3 routes. But I'd like to end this session with doing what I call a short, sharp, shock meditation on death. Now, can I say that if you do this in the evening, before you go to sleep, maybe do a precious human rebirth just to cheer yourselves up. At least do something light. You're done, you know? There's certain meditations that are very good in the morning. Death is one of them. Certain meditations that maybe not so good at night. Maybe death is maybe not the best. Okay, so before you go to bed, do something a bit lighter. So please, as we're finishing, just get yourself into a good situation, nice body posture, moving about if you have to at the moment. When you're ready, coming inward, relaxing, releasing tension, brightening the mind. And consider what the Buddha said about impermanence and death. Just let your mind rest on this. All collections end up running out, without exception. All collections end up running out. That which is high ends up falling. Meetings end in separation. Living ends in death. With conviction, think to yourself, I will definitely die. Day by day, my life is slipping away. Reality. It's useful to feel if you're feeling uncomfortable at this time or there's a kind of disbelief, but I will definitely die. Day by day, my life is slipping away. I have no idea when it will happen or how it will happen. I am completely uncertain. All birth ends in decay. Can you think of any sentient being birth that doesn't end in decay? All around I can see young people often dying before the elderly. Happens so often. I can see that children can die and do die before their parents. It's not talked about often, but many deaths occur in the womb without you even knowing it. Many deaths occur in the womb. And so many don't survive the trauma of birth. Whatever I surround myself with, there is no certainty anywhere. Even if I were to give myself a whole day jotting down all the different things inside the house, outside the house that could kill me, a whole day wouldn't be enough. So many things can end my life. This body is very fragile. It exists within very, very narrow margins. A slight drop in temperature or rise in temperature, even a few degrees, can make you so ill, even kill you. We are alive because of very narrow margins. There is no guarantee anywhere that I will not die today. There is no guarantee. Now think. It's very possible that I could die today. Make that strong in your mind and focus on the feeling that that evokes. I may die today. Whatever feeling arises, focus on that. Thank you. So, it is my intention tomorrow morning to lead you to death and beyond. Just a bit of a heads up. It's my intention to take you through the death process. Some of you will have been through the death process before. It is my intention to lead you through the death process. So basically, tomorrow morning, we're going to learn how to die. Something joyful to look forward to. I hope to see you all then. In the meantime, what I will ask you to do is to set this up sometime tonight, not last thing at night, last thing, smiles, happy thoughts, precious human rebirth, this type of thing. But before that, try to think of a situation where you're actually dying. Think of what you're dying of, right? Not too much pain. You're going to be in a bed. It could be in the hospital. It could be in your house. Choose whichever you like. It's going to be a kind of slow, not slow, but it's going to be a progressive death. So it's not going to be a quick death, but it's going to be progressive. So let your mind wander about that. And when we start tomorrow, we'll put yourself into that situation where you're dying. Where are you? What are you dying of? Are you in a hospital at your home? What is it like? What environment do you have? Who are the people with you? This type of thing. Okay? Yeah, and don't tell me Dharma's not fun. Mm. Yes, Vina.
You know, earlier you said if the mind is beginningless, then there's no aging, sickness, and death.
Okay. Don't take me too literally. Don't take me too literally here. What I was trying to say here is, yes, of course, there's birth, sickness, aging, and death. We have it. We have it. So what we have is concepts. These are concepts that we decide upon in order to navigate our way through our sentient life, right? You see? In and of themselves, there's nothing solid in those. They're labels that we use in order to donate, to emphasize a particular period. Of course, there's sickness, aging, old age, and death, definitely, but do they exist in and of themselves? No, they don't. They require that label to be put on them. Years ago, I remember my father saying to me, at my day, there was no such thing as teenagers. The concept didn't exist. But now when we think of teenagers, it's almost solid and inherently so. So now there's a period of life which is teenagers, nobody would argue with you. But there's a time when it wasn't.
So when we do this meditation tomorrow,
yes,
should we do it with the awareness of the death process being absent of inherent existence?
I would, you see, there's different levels of doing this death process. And the levels are dictated by how much study you've done, what type of study you've done. For instance, if I was doing a death process and I was teaching, I never teach Tantra, but say I was teaching Tantra, then that death process would include visualization of channels, winds, drops. Yes? All that would be in it. If I were doing it for another group that I just taught about the five aggregates, for instance, or the five elements, I would include in the death process commentary on the aggregates in depth, commentary on the elements in depth, right? What we're going to do tomorrow, although I might mention, maybe not, I might mention things like aggregates, I'm going to be focusing on what we already have been taught. So it's abbreviated in a way, but it's always abbreviated depending on your level of understanding and study. But it's going to be based on what we already know with mind, with consciousness, with sense consciousness. Remember I said sense consciousness wasn't, they're not permanent. So I'm doing the death process. There's nothing, what I'm teaching is completely accurate. It just will be missing certain things. So I would focus simply on the dissolution of the mind, the dissolution of the body, going with the flow there. I mean, if you're comfortable with thinking about impermanence and all the rest, fair enough, fair enough. At the time of death, that may come to your mind, but I'm going to be really focusing on the dissolution of the body, how that looks to people who are in the room with you, how it feels to you, what type of visions come to your mind. These visions that come to your mind have it's got a genesis, but I won't go into that because I've not taught that. Do you see what I'm saying? So it will all be exactly accurate for the Dharma, but there'll be certain things I won't go into at all. So I would literally just go with the flow. If you're on your deathbed and you suddenly have a feeling of this impermanence or emptiness or whatever, then go with that. But it won't be dictated by my leading you in the meditation, no. Is that okay? Okay. So I hope you have, I hope you managed to do the study this evening with that. If we were doing a weekend on death, then we'd be doing this together, but it's not a weekend on death. So I'm trying to do the best within the space that we have. So please enjoy the rest of the day. I hope you get together to do some study. Remember to go to sleep, if possible. Precious Human Rebirth, very nice. So let's just remember the motivation that we had right at the very beginning. Finishing our concept of mind and Precious Human Rebirth, death. This is pivotal. Pivotal. So the merit you create very high. So now we're going to dedicate that merit. Prayers are very helpful, very useful in helping to dedicate. So we do the prayers, page 235. Due to the merits of these virtuous actions, may I quickly attain the state of a Guru Buddha and lead all living beings without exception into that enlightened state. May the supreme jewel bodhicitta that has not arisen arise and grow, and may that which has arisen not diminish, but increase more and more. Thank you very much.